Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative. Welcome to the Capital Connection. Hi, this is David Gustina. Delighted today to be with Dr. Bruce Dierstein, who's here to talk about his latest book, Progressive New York, Change and Reform in the Empire State, 1900 to 1920. A reader, it's published by SUNY Press this year, 2024. To give you some background, Bruce Dierstein holds a BA in history from Hartwick College and a PhD in history from Syracuse University. He's taught history at SUNY Albany, SUNY Potsdam, and Russell Sage College. Dr. Dierstein has written dozens of articles on history, archives, libraries, and related topics for several publications. So many amazing works, and we get to talk about another one today. Again, the book, Progressive New York, Change and Reform in the Empire State, 1900 to 1920. Welcome, Dr. Bruce Dierstein.
Well, thank you. I'm very glad to be on the program. It's always good to talk about history, and particularly right now when history is very important.
No question about it. Well, let's start with that basic question. Why did you choose for this book the period between 1900 and 1920, the so-called progressive reform era?
Well, during most of my career, I've been particularly interested in that period, particularly in New York State history, which is mostly what I write about, because it always seemed to me it was populated by some fascinating characters, and there was an awful lot that went on, some of which we knew a lot about, some of which we didn't until we'd done some more research. And the latest book is a little different from my previous books in the sense that it is a collection of documents from the period. There are about 72 documents in there written by all kinds of folks, from newspapers, reports, articles, some polemical materials, advocacy, and so on. And so this is history, in a sense, firsthand, first person, people speaking for themselves about what they saw and what they were doing. And yeah, I think as this has come out about 6 months ago, it has seemed to me, as you were just implying, that there is a lot that we can learn from it today. The period, I think, right about the beginning of the time that I cover, up to about 1900, was a period of anxiety and stress. People were concerned about the accumulated problems from the 19th century, industrialization, urbanization, income inequality, and so on, and also the new technology, which in those days was cars, airplanes, and so on. And so a lot of what the progressives did, particularly here in New York, was to try to search for ways of dealing with this change, because the progressives were all about not accepting the status quo, but making responsible changes in a gradual and pragmatic way. So there are lots of studies and reports, which led eventually to some pretty substantial changes. One of the things that is in this new book, there is a fair amount of exhortation for individuals to change how they looked at things, for business people, leaders of industry, to change how they looked at things and accommodate workers and with better working conditions and wages more. And then, as sort of a last resort almost, turning to government. There's a lot in here about the advent of government regulation. So I think there is a similar anxiety today. I think we saw it play out in this recently completed election. And whether there will be now some sort of set of solutions which deals with the problems we're facing, I think we have to see. I think people are worried about things from immigration to inflation and so on. So we're at an inflection point, or hopefully a beginning point, of dealing with some of these issues in an effective way.
We're speaking with Dr. Bruce Dierstein. The book, Progressive New York, Change and Reform in the Empire State from 1900 to 1920. Before we go any further, let's give a definition. You know, progressive folks, progressivism, progressive reform, the idea of it seems to be we're not happy with the status quo, and in large part, we want to raise the standard of living. But place that definition in that time frame we're talking about, 1900 to 1920.
Yeah, I start out with a broad definition, which is people in groups who are dissatisfied with the status quo, thought we could do better, and were determined to improve it. It's confusing because it was also a progressive party. Only one year, as it turned out, 1912, there have been progressive parties since then. And some folks today, like Senator Bernie Sanders, Senator Elizabeth Warren, are characterized as being progressive. And in a sense, they all have a kinship and similarity. But folks today are different in the sense that they think more about federal government intervention and so on. In the period I'm talking about, a lot of the action was with the states. So it's about a perception that we can do better and a desire to bring about some change in the right direction. But the folks I write about were not revolutionaries. They were not going to defend the status quo, but they didn't want to overthrow it either. They were trying to make things better for average people, trying to rein in some of the excesses of the era. For instance, a lot of your listeners may have been following the Gilded Age on television. Well, that's the way some of the country, at least, saw New York City around 1900. But contrasted with that, there were some very poor areas in New York City, and New York was very diverse and changing all the time. For instance, there were a lot of immigrants coming in 1907. Over 1 million immigrants came into New York City. So the progressives tried to kind of rise above all that, take all of it into account, try to reconcile things, try to criticize the extremes on both sides, radicals who wanted to overthrow things and bring in something entirely new, and ultra-conservatives who didn't want to make any change at all. So if this sounds complicated, that's because it was. And if you ask any of the folks that I write about or I quote in this book, they would have said, yeah, you think it's complicated. And if you've been here when we were actually going through it, you would have seen how complicated it is. I think they were also kind of patient. They knew it was going to take some time to make changes, and indeed it did.
Well, yeah, they really believed in this sort of incremental change, right? Working within the system to hopefully get to change. But they also were plagued with their own biases, including racism and other things, anti-Semitism, for example, even among the progressives.
Well, fair to say, yes, there is some of that. Those two things are very hard to discern and measure because some of the progressives, as we look back on them now, seem to hold contradictory views of things about human beings, equality, everyone's created equal, we can't have bias, versus once in a while lapsing into racism, and I think not very often into anti-Semitism. Part of the answer to that question is if you look at New York State, and particularly New York City, that was and probably still is the most diverse city in the country. And so you have a lot of Jewish immigrants coming in. You have black people moving up from the South. And I think you have in New York City, more than most other cities, a spirit of accommodation and tolerance. You also find in New York at this time the growth of Harlem, the so-called Harlem Renaissance, a lot of creativity, artists, musicians, and so on. And you also find, a further complicated story, I guess, in 1909, the NAACP, which is still around today, being founded in New York City. And a lot of New York progressives were among the founders.
What do you equate this to? Do you equate this to because this immigration, the gates were opened and the ports of New York, these millions of these immigrants are coming in, it's forcing the population to think about how to accommodate that, what to do about it. But it seems to me it's the first sign that New York is going to be an incubator, a place where benchmarks are made and the rest of the country is going to copy them.
Yes, that's fair to say. I think that comes across very well in this book. I think that's it's always been true of New York. I think as people were thinking about immigration, they were interested in it. They were mostly open to it. They realized that's what had made New York great. At the same time as there was growing up in the country, including among some New Yorkers, a feeling that we've got to close the gates, we've got to restrict immigration, we've got to get it more toward Northern Europeans, Western Europeans, and fewer Southern Europeans and Eastern Europeans. And that happened indeed in 1924 at the federal level with immigration restriction. But I think in the meantime, New York has sort of set the pace for tolerance, open-mindedness, let's give everybody a fair shake, let's accept folks for who they are, not where they came from or what they look like. One of the things I have in this book, the chapter on immigration, I have a couple of things written by immigrants who came in around 1900 and what they experienced. And their experience was mostly positive. Great accommodations here. You could get a job in advance. You could support yourself. People were tolerant. But once in a while, they ran up against an obstacle or a barrier. They're not going to hire you because you're Jewish, for instance, or you came from a certain part of Eastern Europe. And so I think sometimes people, when they talk to historians, they want this kind of laid out and simplified. It ought to be clear-cut. It ought to be simple and easy to understand. There ought to be parallels. And indeed, I think there are parallels, but it's never quite an exact fit. I think you have to study history, bring your own perceptions and perspectives to it, and then reach your own conclusions. And New York, I think, did set the pace, though, yes.
Yeah, and Dr. Dierstein, author of Progressive New York, Change and Reform in the Empire State, 1900 to 1920, you certainly made me reach my conclusions. And quite frankly, not aligning with your perception, is that it simplified things more for me, coming back to this era and looking at it and seeing, as the former governor of New York, Mario Cuomo, used to talk about, the pendulum swinging back and forth. So you see this move, as you said, positive, a lot of positive talk about the incoming immigrants. And as you said, you know, helping them and they're good for the country. And that's very general terms. But then once we get, what, after Al Smith, once you get into 1918, 1920 area, then you start to see the language changing again and that pendulum swinging to, well, who are these people coming over? And we need to re-educate the educators and these kinds of things with more fear involved and worry what this will mean, all these people coming in.
Well, that's well put. And I think that's a dilemma, and it's ironic. There seemed to be a kind of a turnaround, at least at the national level, maybe to some degree in New York, right around 1918, 1920. For instance, we had a very progressive governor, Al Smith, elected in 1918. He was making some very good changes, including simplifying state government, and he's going to bring aboard a budgeting system, which he eventually did in the 1920s. And we had a very progressive president, Woodrow Wilson, though by then fighting for membership in the League of Nations, which was to be unsuccessful, as it turned out. But in 1920, certain complacency seemed to set in, a certain normalcy or desire for normalcy, which was Warren Harding's term, the Republicans' term. And so Warren Harding was elected president in 1920 over the Democrats, Cox, and Al Smith was voted out of office by Nathan Miller, who himself would be displaced a couple of years later. And, you know, things seemed to change. The tenor of the discussion seemed to change. And this sort of anxiety about newcomers seemed to kind of bubble to the top. I think that's in part because during the First World War, there had been so much emphasis on 100% Americanism, the American way, the American
America guide, first.
America first, which would come up again and again, by the way. And people were sort of churned up by that during the war. And there was a lot of crusading against hyphenated Americans, German Americans, and so on. And a bellwether on a lot of this was Theodore Roosevelt, former governor, former president, candidate for president again in 1912, a pretty tolerant guy up to a point. But during the war, he led the crusade against German Americans, hyphenated Americans, waving the flag, and so on. And so, I mean, I take your point. I think most people, or many people at least, would agree with you. I don't know what's to come any more than anyone else does. I can say, as I hear people express apprehension about the future, I think it's more intense and widespread and perhaps more serious and justified than in the past. But there was a lot of fear about Theodore Roosevelt in 1912 running for president on the progressive ticket. What would he do if he got in? Well, he'd be a dictator. He would never get out. He'd enact all kinds of things. Of course, he was defeated. And there was a milder fear balanced by hope when Franklin Roosevelt came in 1932, because there are a fair number of people in the country who thought, well, he's going to be a socialist. We don't know what he's going to do. He's not going to save capitalism. And of course,
he did just that.
He does exactly that. So loving a Pollyanna or telling people not to worry, because I think we always have to be concerned about government and about our rights and what's going to happen. My only perspective would be, well, but in the past we've been divided too, and people are worried about it. And usually it's turned out to be not as good as the proponents hoped it would be and predicted, but not as bad as the critics and a lot of other folks feared it would be. And that's because things tend to balance out in this country. I don't know if it will this time. It's president and Congress. Well, the Congress may be controlled by the same party's president this time. Then it's the courts and the states and the media. And America is such a wonderful place, in part because of this marvelous complexity. And there are a lot of players in the issue of federal policymaking. So we'll see. I think quite a few people feel, and I think with justification, New York State is kind of a bulwark, a defender of our liberties. And the state constitution, which we kind of forget about because it's there and doesn't seem to matter much, suddenly matters a great deal. And so we had an amendment for vote to the state constitution, Proposition 1. People voted it in. There's some feeling that the New York State Court of Appeals will be somewhat of a buttress or a bulwark against the U.S. Supreme Court, which is pretty conservative these days, and that our governor will become a spokesperson for against maybe some of the things that President Trump may try to do, as her predecessor was when he was in last time, which makes it, I think, all the more interesting to be a New Yorker.
Yeah, and in your book, you know, you talk about some of the African-American women who founded the NAACP, and that very organization came out immediately after Trump was elected and said, we're going to be a bulwark against any rights he tries to take away.
Yeah, and another one that did is the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, also founded in New York, I think 1919, and sort of with the same idea in mind. We are here to defend people's liberties, whether you agree with them or not, or think they take the right stance on things or not. And so you do find often, I think, kind of popping up in New York, either in the government or in organizations, groups that are in favor of people's rights, civil rights, social justice. That's kind of part of our DNA, I guess. You know, I've written a lot about New York history. I say we usually get it right. We may not get it right the first time around, and we have to change things, you know, after we try some things out and see how they work. But New York usually gets it right. And I think we will again this time. I don't know what's going to happen at the federal level. We'll just have to see. I think the election surprised a lot of people, particularly the magnitude of President Trump's victory. But it is what it is. You know, the American people have spoken, as they get to do every 4 years, and now we will see.
We are speaking with Dr. Bruce Dierstein, author of Progressive New York, Change and Reform in the Empire State from 1900 to 1920, published by SUNY Press. I want to go back now because I kind of want to go a little bit more in order of how you approach this. We started with that definition, which you give of progressivism in New York.
Right.
And then we begin to move into this issue of reforming politics and government. And I think everyone who's listening right now, if they haven't, certainly someone in their family or someone they know has heard of Senator George Washington Plunkett and Plunkett of Tammany Hall, of course, newsman William Riordan being dictated to by Plunkett. And it is something to read that. You know, I haven't read it in a while, and you have an excerpt in the book, but, you know, I'd seen my opportunities and I took them. The idea of honest and dishonest graft. And to me, the heart of where the people begin to lose their faith in institutions like state government and federal government, because they believe that that's exactly how politicians operate. If they're not stealing directly from the till, they're using their influence to raise their bank account.
Well, yeah. Plunkett was a New York State senator representing the powerful Democratic organization called Tammany Hall. And much of what Tammany Hall did was quiet behind the scenes, but Plunkett used to talk about it. And anyone could listen to him, and William O. Riordan, who was a newsman, did. And later published it.
It is amazing, really, if you think about the things that he's talking about.
Well, yeah, he was talking about things like, I sort of know from an insider that the city maybe is going to build a park in a certain area. And so I go in quietly, I buy up the land, and then when the city decides to build the park, I sell it to them, you know, a good profit. What's wrong with that?
It's like a stockbroker admitting to insider trading.
It is exactly. I think people looking back at it now will say, well, of course it's wrong. Come on, Plunkett, you probably knew it was wrong too. But I think he means to contrast that with things like outright bribes, real graft, dishonest graft, like we would have today. Looking ahead a little bit, in 1910, the majority leader of the state Senate, New York State Senate, had to resign because it came out he took a bribe.
That's right.
Back years ago when he was in the assembly to sway votes on a certain topic. And other leaders of the assembly, happened to be Republicans, had also taken bribes. So Plunkett might say, that's the difference between them and me. I didn't take bribes. Maybe he did, but he didn't get caught. But I think the other thing to note about Plunkett and Charles F. Murphy, who was the head of Tammany Hall, was Plunkett was a passing breed even as he was speaking. And Tammany Hall, another bellwether, I think, sort of watched to see which way the wind was blowing. And after the tragic 1911 Triangle Shirtwaist Fire in New York City, which killed a lot of workers, Tammany perceived the need for better state safety regulations, more state inspections. It sort of began to understand that we're going to have direct primaries. And so a few years later from after Plunkett, say 1912 or so, if you were looking for the leaders, the outstanding leaders of the Democratic Party, it wouldn't be Plunkett anymore. It would be, well, Assemblyman Al Smith,
yep.
Senator Robert Wagner, who later went on to be a United States Senator, and Senator Franklin Roosevelt, who was there, elected in 1910, wasn't really one of the prominent leaders, but was one of the movers and shakers. And so, yeah, I think if people look back at Plunkett, they'll see some echoes of things which today we would regard as absolutely outrageous. Now, you'd think, oh, Tammany Hall, they were terrible, corrupt. Well, yeah, some of it was. For a long time, they were. But after a while, they sort of went with the flow. And in fact, in the case of Al Smith and Bob Wagner, who headed a big legislative investigation of factory conditions after the Triangle Fire, they actually led some of the reform. In the end, as women's suffrage was being voted on a second time, 1917, it failed the first time, 1915, Charles F. Murphy, who still had Tammany Hall, said, well, I dropped my opposition to it, which was tantamount to saying, go ahead and vote in favor of it, which his followers did. One of the other issues is workers' compensation, which was enacted during this period and which we have now. It's essentially the same as it was put in 1913.
And it makes sense, right? Because you told us earlier that this great industrialization had occurred. You know, you have all this new technology. You have cars and planes and the trains and everything else that's there now is, because it's not regulated, causing a lot of accidents, women and children and men. And so you have someone like Crystal Eastman who comes in and really lobbies to get something done about this.
Yeah, that's well put. If there is one person who is worth following the whole time, it's Crystal Eastman, because she kind of pops up as a reformer in several venues, including women's suffrage. She does a big study of factory accidents. She's on the commission which writes the workers' compensation law. Later, she lapses a little more to the left. Her brother was a leading socialist, but she's kind of someone to watch. New York was the first state to enact a real workers' compensation law in 1910. The federal government had one. It was weak, but no other states did. And in fact, the precedent they followed was actually England. So it was enacted in 1910, kind of limited, kind of tentative, but ruled unconstitutional next year, 1911, just before the Triangle Fire that I mentioned, so that all those folks who were injured and died in that blaze, none of them were qualified for workers' compensation, which they would have been had the law lasted. However, New York State turned around, like it often did, and amended its own constitution in 1913 and immediately passed a new, stronger, broader, more inclusive workers' compensation law, which then a lot of other states followed.
Well, I want to move a little more quickly. We're speaking with Dr. Bruce Dierstein. His latest book, Progressive New York, Change and Reform in the Empire State, published by SUNY Press, and he's covering 1900 to 1920. Now, journalism did a great deal here between 1900 and 1920 to bring stories to the fore. But I want to go back to Teddy Roosevelt for a minute, because he's the one that coins the term muckraker. Muckrakers. And it was negative. It was pejorative when he used it. And yet Muckrakers to this day, I think most people think in positive terms as good journalists who dig up the real story, the truth. And even social reformers and journalists like Jacob Riis on poverty were out there exposing things that forced government to make change.
Yes, you got that exactly right. That term he used in a 1906 speech, which is now available online, I'd urge people to go back and read it, because in that same speech, he's very progressive. He's very emphatic. We've got to change. We can't stand pat. And then, as he often does, his typical theory flips. And he says, however, we have some people in the Fourth Estate, writers, going too far and constantly searching for dirt, for things to fling up. They're bad, but they exaggerate and make them bad. It's ironic because some of the so-called muckrakers that helped Roosevelt get done a lot of what he got done, which includes the Pure Food and Drug Act, because there were exposés of how bad food packing was and so on. So I don't know. You're right.
Yeah, right. And that pendulum still swings today, right? Where we went through the era of Watergate, for example, which brought the credibility and respect of journalism to where we are right at this moment, where it's fake news and we can't trust anybody and they're sensationalizing things. So that pendulum swings back and forth.
Yes, it does.
Not only that, Dr. Dierstein, but from my perspective on public broadcasting, they don't see it as their responsibility. This is public officials. And I think that does a disservice to, you know, the kinds of conversations we need to have as communities.
Of course it does, because the media is always useful in the sense of both giving elected public officials a way to air their views and in challenging them in the sense of asking them tough questions and holding their feet to the fire, making them answer them.
Dr. Bruce Dierstein, it has been a pleasure speaking with you on this week's Capital Connection about your book, Progressive New York, Change and Reform in the Empire State, 1900 to 1920. It's published by SUNY Press. There's so much more I could have talked with you about, but I appreciate you taking all this time today to talk a little bit about the history of New York, and I hope people will see it reflected in what we're going through right now. Thanks again, Dr. Dierstein.
Thank you.
Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative.